Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's hot outside, or so we hear from the multitudes of you living anywhere but on the left coast. The fires in Colorado are an immediate result of that heat, but in the middle of the country, it's a slower burn, one that could send many a farmer to ruin. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Monday, the second day of July. Kai, by the way, is on assignment in Montana, working on a Marketplace production with the PBS program Frontline. He's in Helena, where it's a balmy 76 degrees, not nearly as hot as in so many other parts of the country. Records are falling everywhere. Heat maps of the nation are bright red through the nation's midsection and all the way to the eastern seaboard. One of the worst spots is Hill City, Kansas, where the temperature recently hit 115 degrees several days in a row. That is the worst kind of news for farmers in the region, among them Ace Billups. He's been farming for more than 40 years. His place in Hill City has about 800 cows, plus he grows corn and wheat and other grains. They and he are all wilting in the weather. Ace Billups, nice to talk to you.
Yeah.
How hot is it outside right now?
Right around 100 right now.
And how long has it been since it rained there?
Oh, the last real rain we had was about the 20th of April. We had about 3/4 of an inch.
Talk to me about what it's like there on a daily basis, dealing with this heat and trying to save the workings of your farm.
Oh, I'd say it's getting awful depressing. There's virtually nothing to save. I mean, you just, every day you get up and it just looks a little bit worse out and a little bit worse. And then last week when the terrible heat hit, it just, the corn and stuff was, you know, holding on. Not good, but it was holding on. But then it just came in and it just took the leaves and just turned them like a grayish white. I mean, just in a few hours, it just went from green to virtually ruining the plants. The corn, everywhere I've been around here anyway, the corn is virtually going to be zero on bushels of corn.
What happens to your finances if you lose all that corn?
Oh, so I don't know if you know what crop insurance is. You've got insurance that will usually pay for your input costs and things like that. You know, you won't make any money, but you may get your original cost, planting costs back. So you're just, you know, virtually out of year's worth of work.
Can you compare what's happening now to previous years in your long history as a farmer?
Well, our personal farm, we've never had nothing would even compare to this.
So what do you do then as the year goes on? I mean, how do you live?
Well, I don't know. We'll still have cattle to sell eventually. I mean, and come September, 1st of October, we'll plant wheat, and hopefully there'll be some moisture by then to grow some wheat. And if it doesn't, then you'll buy that crop insurance again and take whatever you get off the crop insurance to pay your people that you've bought the fertilizer and seed and stuff from. You'll get enough money to pay them back. You know, you just hope for another year. Just hope for rain. That's about all you can do.
Ace Billups is a farmer in Hill City, Kansas, and we've been talking about the drought conditions there. Thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck to you.
All righty. Thank you.
On Wall Street, an unexpected dip in manufacturing activity did not shake up traders too much. The NASDAQ and S&P 500 both closed on an up note. We'll have details when we do the numbers. So I went to post on Instagram Friday evening a photo of the beautiful Pasadena City Hall building at night, and I got this error message. And so did everyone else who uses Instagram or Netflix or Pinterest. What mayhem was this? Well, it was a storm, which, by the way, caused all kinds of untold actual damage, as well as the horror of not being able to post pictures of what you're eating. But what happened here was the storm brought down Amazon's cloud computing service, which is actually a sea of servers where businesses house their computing operations. It may also have sparked a new round of competition in one of technology's fastest-growing businesses, Marketplace's Queena Kim reports.
Amazon is one of the biggest and oldest players in the cloud. It's been there since way back in 2006. But the industry is getting crowded.
There are a number of players in the space, private companies now. It's a very large landscape.
Daniel Kurnis is an analyst at Benchmark. He doesn't think the outage will hurt Amazon, but competitors didn't waste any time capitalizing on it.
Joyent, for example, company that's in Northern Virginia, was up during the storm, and they were first to come out and say, hey, we didn't have any problems.
Renting out server space in the cloud is worth about $3 billion a year, according to Forrester Research. Amazon is estimated to have about a third of the market and rent to everyone from biggies like Fox Entertainment and Unilever to startups. But now giants like Google are getting in. It said last week that it's starting a cloud service. What happened during the storm isn't the first big outage for Amazon. Lydia Leung is an analyst with Gartner. She says that while customers have been patient with the emerging industry and its missteps, that might change.
Things like our generators didn't kick in when we expected them to, that isn't considered to be an acceptable problem, right? That becomes the, you know, you should understand how to do this and be doing that well already.
What they may need to understand first is whether the cloud was a victim of Mother Nature or has man-made technical problems. In San Francisco, I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
From now until Election Day, you can pretty much guarantee that politicians will be talking about the Affordable Care Act. The left will celebrate it as history-making legislation. The right will say it's historic in a totally different way.
This indeed is the largest tax in the history of our country.
That is Congressman Philip Gingrey. Kai interviewed him last week after the Supreme Court's decision to uphold the ACA. Well, is he right? Is the Affordable Care Act the largest tax in the history of our country? We sent Marketplace's Shireen Marisol Meraji to find out.
First off, thank you for not asking me to find out whether the Affordable Care Act is what Rush Limbaugh calls
the largest tax increase in the history of the world.
That would be a much tougher assignment. As for the largest increase in U.S. history, tax expert and Northwestern law professor Charlotte Crane says,
heavens no, I think by any measure.
And here's Joseph Thorndike,
director of the Tax History Project at Tax Analysts.
He says even after adjusting for inflation,
the Clinton tax hike in 93 was substantially bigger, and the Reagan tax hike of 1982 was really much bigger.
Ed Zielinski's a law professor who's written a lot about health care and says quibbling over whether the Affordable Care Act is the biggest tax increase since Genghis Khan is not the point.
I think it's a significant increase. I don't think it has to be overstated or that it has to be described hyperbolically to say that it's an important issue that's worth discussing.
Zielinski points to the ACA's tax increase on Americans making $200,000 a year and the nearly 4% tax on their investment income. He says that could affect the way the proverbial 1% spends and could hurt the economy. But Joseph Thorndike of the Tax History Project says it's simpler just to say
that this is the biggest tax hike since 1993, which is, you know, hey, that's a long time ago.
Thorndike says that's a much more defensible argument than calling the Affordable Care Act the biggest tax increase in American history. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
It took me a long time to write this lead to the next part of our show. Kind of put it off. I delayed until the last possible minute. Just couldn't get myself to focus on it. And perhaps we're all better for that, because now it's brilliant. Wouldn't you agree? Well, Frank Partnoy would. He's a professor of law and finance at the University of San Diego School of Law and author of the new book, Wait, The Art and Science of Delay. And I thought about making him wait longer to join us, but with no further delay possible, Frank, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
So first of all, as one of the worst procrastinators on the face of the earth, let me thank you for saying that this is okay.
I'm here to tell you you're doing just the right thing. And instead of procrastination, you should call it managing delay. You're not procrastinating, you're managing delay. And it's a very important lesson in life and in business, which is to delay gratification. People are better off and happier. They make better decisions when they're able to delay gratification. And that's true whether or not the time frame is milliseconds long or months long or years long. This is a skill that we learn as children, and it carries us through, helps us later in life.
But that just doesn't fit with the way we think of things these days. I mean, everything is about speed right now, isn't it?
It is. And the crush of technology is ruining our decision making. The relentlessness of email and social media and the 24-hour news cycle is speeding up our decisions. And the best thing to do is just to take a breath and be cognitively aware of what your own limitations are. Say, you know what? I live in a fast-paced world, and my computer screen is flashing at me, and I'm subject to all this stimulus. What I need to do every once in a while is just take a break, take a deep breath, look outside, stare off into the distance, and that'll help us make better decisions.
Yeah, but then somebody's going to walk by my office and see me staring out into the distance and wonder why I'm not working.
Well, if you read Wait, you'll show them Wait, you'll have a good excuse to show them exactly what it is that you're doing and why.
You do talk in the book about, not just individuals, but how businesses, corporations can use this concept of waiting and have used it to some success, including 3M and the Post-it note.
Yes, the Post-it note is a story that's told everywhere in every business case book. It's even in my daughter's sixth grade science book. And it's often told as an epiphany story, this sudden discovery. But if you look at the truth of the Post-it story, it's a story that developed over a long, long period of time involving two men who were tinkerers as kids who got jobs at 3M, then called Minnesota Mining, known as Mother Mining, which was a very nurturing company that gave them 15% free time to develop their crazy ideas that might never be monetized. The process of developing the Post-it took a total of 12 years. So one of the things I wanted to try to show in the book is that companies who are successful innovators are willing to wait, and that the epiphany story is often not true. Isaac Newton did not get hit on the head by an apple. Thomas Edison did not suddenly invent the light bulb overnight. And companies need to understand this and devote themselves to the long haul. And the long haul means years and years and years before they'll have true innovation.
Then why is it, do you think, that the myth persists that these are all just kind of flashes that happen?
We want that to be true. We want it to be easy to innovate. We want to believe that we'll be able to invent the next mousetrap suddenly, and that the first mover advantage is always the right way. It's a very attractive, almost romantic story about corporate innovation. The only problem with it is that it's not true. Sometimes the first mouse is in great danger of getting eaten by a cat, and so the second mouse gets the cheese. There's a lot of academic literature that shows that there's a second mover advantage in a lot of businesses, that it's often better to wait.
All right. Well, next time my producer asks me why my feature isn't done, I'm just going to tell him that it gets better and better the longer I wait to write it.
And at the last minute, you'll come through with some brilliant insight and you'll produce a piece just like this one.
Frank Partnoy is the author of Wait, The Art and Science of Delay. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And if you've been waiting to figure out what LIBOR is and why something in London could affect your adjustable rate mortgage or even your student loans, our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore has the answer. It's called LIBOR for Mortals, an easy explainer. You can check it out at marketplace.org/EasyStreet. Coming up, you're the boss, you call the shots, you hire, you fire. What do you do when one of your employees makes a mistake?
Do you A, say nothing, B, say, that's all right, as long as you can figure out what you did, or C, say, you've got your head up your ass.
Get ready for a quiz, but first, let's do the numbers. An unexpected drop in factory orders took the shine off last week's rally. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped a fraction, 8 points, to close at 12,871. The Nasdaq, however, rose a half percent, that's 16 points, to end at 2,951. The S&P 500 bumped up a quarter percent, 3 points, to finish at 1,365. The chill in manufacturing nipped at big industrials like Alcoa and Caterpillar, both down around a percent and a half. GE lost 1 2/3. DuPont slipped nearly 2 1/3. Financials, though, were in mostly positive territory. Morgan Stanley led the pack, rising 2.4%. J.P. Morgan Chase was up 1.5%. Goldman Sachs was close behind at 1 1/3. And Bank of America, though, fell 1.5%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.59%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. Are consumers in the market for new cars? Automakers are slated to release U.S. sales for the month of June. The National Education Association continues its annual meeting in Washington. Vice President Joe Biden speaks. And the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for May. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Mexico has picked a new president following elections over the weekend. Enrique Peña Nieto got about 38% of the vote, though a runner-up candidate has refused to concede. Nieto's victory marks the return to power of the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI. It ruled Mexico for 70 years before being ousted in 2000 amid allegations of corruption. This time, though, Mexico's people are hoping the PRI can bring stability and some measure of economic hope. Jennifer Collins reports from Mexico City.
Lulu Catarino is 22 years old. She runs a sweet stand and lives in Mexico City. And her favorite clothes come from
El Colesti.
Hollister, owned by the American retailer Abercrombie & Fitch.
Porque es cómoda.
Because it's comfortable, because it's not too ugly.
But a Hollister t-shirt can cost her a week's wages. Enrique Peña Nieto won election promising that Mexicans will earn more under his administration. And it's for that reason Catarino voted for him.
Poder darnos más trabajo.
He can give us more work, more security. We're hoping for real change right now with Enrique Peña.
Joy Langston is a professor at Mexico City Center for Research and Teaching in Economics.
You know, Mexicans love consumer goods, love consumer durables, love clothes, love TVs, love everything. You know, there's nothing really radically different between a Mexican family, a middle-class family, and an American middle-class family.
Almost 2/3 of Mexican imports come from the U.S., so better wages could create more demand. But it's those low wages that have also helped Mexico improve its competitiveness against a country like China. Mexico City economics professor Duncan Wood says Enrique Peña Nieto will have to walk a very fine line.
If there's going to be much greater involvement by the federal government in how much you're paid for a particular task, then I think there would be severe resistance from industry for that.
The last thing the country wants is for anything to interrupt the flow of exports, 3/4 of which go to the U.S. In Mexico City, I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
A subsidiary of oil giant Anadarko is preparing to defend itself in court this week. Plaintiffs in the case just finished laying out their case in New York. They're demanding $25 billion as compensation for alleged toxic pollution at hundreds of chemical sites around the country. A small town in northeastern Pennsylvania is among those seeking redress for a suspiciously high rate of cancer. Scott Tong has more from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
In itty-bitty Avoca, Pennsylvania, the thing to do is sneak onto the old chemical site right behind the baseball field.
Ah, one more. I got to get a good one.
Coach, Catfish BP?
No. Please?
The hole in the fence leads to 35 acres of weeds, concrete slabs, couple no trespassing signs. The plant shut down 16 years ago. 48-year-old Michael Sable has been slipping in here for years.
Oh, God, they could sneak through the fence, claim on the tie. Everybody used to play on the ties.
Ties? as in railroad ties. This town's product was a bit player in the Industrial Revolution, which in these parts started with coal and songs like this.
We get up in the black down the coal town road, and we hike along a track where the coal trains load.
Coal needs freight trains and tracks, which sit on railroad ties. Here in Avoca, the workers took wood planks and soaked them in a black chemical sludge to prevent rotting. They set them out to dry, and the kids came.
Used to jump on it. It was pretty neat. It was like a big fort because they were 5 stories high. And as far as the eye could see, it was just all railroad ties in here.
The place reeked. Everyone here talks about the smell.
It smelled like mothballs.
Almost like a burning tire, like a rubbery chemical.
It smelled terrific. Couldn't stand it. He had to shut the doors and windows that night.
You ever see how they burn them incense for Christmas, like mix about 10 different blends together, put burning wood and put some motor oil in there and transmission fluid? It probably smells like that when it burns.
You ever walk on railroad tracks when they first put new ties in? It smells like that, but a million times stronger.
Talk of the plant always leads to talk of cancer. Michael Sable's grandfather worked there. He died of lung cancer. His dad has throat cancer. His two best friends went to St. Mary's School overlooking the plant.
One died in 2010. He died of lung cancer. And my other buddy, Michael, he died in September of 2011 of brain cancer. It was just strange that they're both dead now.
Child brain cancer occurs 8 times more than the county average. Infant liver cancer, 20 times more. Birth defects, way above the norm.
Webbed toes, abnormal larynx, Down syndrome, short fingers or toes.
Toxicologist Patricia Williams of the University of New Orleans has done the local studies.
Cerebral palsy, or they were born with teeth, or born with cataracts, or born with half a heart.
Town residents sued the company, which at the time was the oil and chemical titan called Kerr McGee. Heard of it? Ever since the 1980s movie Silkwood?
They're trying to kill me. They want me to stop what I'm doing.
It's based on a true story about a Kerr McGee whistleblower played by Meryl Streep.
They contaminated me, you know that?
I know.
I'm so scared now.
She died mysteriously in a car crash. The old mayor of Avoca, Jim Haddock, thinks Kerr McGee tried to threaten him. An anonymous caller once asked if he'd seen Silkwood and then hung up. Haddock says Kerr McGee kept changing its story while he was running the town. First, the plant was safe. Then they said it had environmental liability.
They had concern for grave liability, and all of a sudden they're saying now it's clean. That's a company that I can't trust. They lied to me as mayor of this community.
Lawsuits have been going for 7 years. People here and at other Kerr McGee sites around the country say the company tried to skip out on paying medical claims. How? Kerr McGee created a new company a few years ago called Tronox, which was responsible for all the payouts. Tronox went bankrupt. John Houston, representing the plaintiffs, says it was all by design.
And at the time that they spun off Tronox, Tronox was not solvent. It was doomed to failure. The company took what should have been monies set aside to redress harms like that and made it disappear.
Kerr McGee denies any scheme. It says Tronox failed because of the economy. Kerr McGee is now part of the oil company Anadarko. Spokesman Brian Kane.
Tronox's situation was not at all unique in the challenging economic environment that resulted in the collapse of the housing market and the automobile industry. The collapse of those industries resulted in lessened demand for Tronox's primary product.
Plaintiffs now on $25 billion in the case now in New York court. If they win, some money goes to the victims, some to cleaning up old chemical sites like this one. If they lose, their lawyers say it's probably the end of the line. In Avoca, northeastern Pennsylvania, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
And for video and photos from Scott's reporting trip, head over to marketplace.org. Most of us have made, one or two mistakes during our working careers. Maybe your boss handled it well, maybe not. Well, if you are the boss and somebody goofs up, commentator Teresa Amabile has a multiple choice question for you.
Congratulations. You're the chief operating officer of a well-known consumer products company. Today, you're presiding over a big review of new products being developed. The room is packed with product teams, VPs, and other top brass. You turn to the team presenting a new blender, but the team leader sheepishly admits the prototype isn't ready. There was a mistake somewhere in the development process, but he's confident the team will fix it soon. As COO, do you A, say nothing, B, say, That's all right, as long as you can figure out what you did. Or C, say, you've got your head up your ass. This scenario really happened in a company we studied. And the COO went with option C. His words, by the way. But for the good of the company, what he should have said was B. That's the right answer because it fosters something called psychological safety. An atmosphere where it's okay to admit errors because you're not going to get punished or dressed down for an honest mistake. Psychological safety allows people to dispassionately dissect shortcomings so they can learn and improve. The opposite is an atmosphere of intimidation where people avoid taking risks and stifle their creativity. Unfortunately, my research team and I found that many business leaders undervalue respect. When faced with an employee's mistake, far too many rake the person over the coals. A few leaders do get this right. They know that if they respect the worker and focus on what went wrong in the work, their employees are far more likely to be innovative and productive. Research shows that respecting employees can help drive the bottom line upward. Doing the opposite can drive an enterprise into the ground.
Teresa Amabile is a professor at Harvard Business School and the co-author of The Progress Principle.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, remember back when predicting crime before it happened was just a celluloid dream?
By mandate of the District of Columbia Pre-Crime Division, I'm placing you under arrest for the future murder of Sarah Marks and Donald Dubin. That was to take place today, April 22nd, at 0800 hours, 4 minutes.
No, I didn't do anything.
Well, the Los Angeles Police Department is taking a page from Minority Report, utilizing computers in something called predictive policing. It uses statistics to figure out where to best place officers to tamp down on property crimes. The department plans to expand a pilot program despite concerns about it leading to illegal search and seizure. You just know they're trying out spider venom on some new academy recruits, right? You know that's happening? And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped a tiny fraction, 8 points, to close at 12,871. The NASDAQ rose 0.5%, that's 16 points, ending at 2,951. The S&P bumped up 0.25%, 3 points, to finish at 1,365. Our producers include Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Warm welcome to our new listeners on WGBH in Boston. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us again tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.